Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Thank you for joining us today, Pete. We know you at the Label as an expert and a leader in market research and for your time at Kantar. Really getting to the heart of sort of consumer data and understanding buying behavior through data. I'd love to hear a little bit about it in your words. Could you introduce yourself and give us a sense of your career journey from there?
So I'm 30 years of, primarily consumer behavior, studying consumer behavior, selling consumer behavior and analyzing consumer behavior in all its different guises. My career started in a very much a commercial role, so working with the primarily the big kind of blue chip FMCG companies, the likes of P&G and Coca-Cola, all of that gang, really trying to bring to life the behavioral data that they were buying from Kantar. Most of my career was or has been at Kantar. So my early days were spent deep in the data, trying to make sense of it and trying to provide insight and consultancy to those big blue chip companies, whether it be about understanding how brands were performing and what strategies they should be applying to try to drive growth, or whether it was more tactical about understanding how to achieve listings in retailers or how to drive sales through retailers. It was that kind of game. And it was partly analytical and partly sales, so actually trying to encourage those manufacturers or retailers to buy more of our data sets because they could help answer more of their questions. So I started it, as I say, in a very commercial environment, but with a strong analytical bias to it, which is quite a weird kind of mix of skills to some extent. I moved from there into more of a strategic role, so trying to help shape primarily the UK's business initially, trying to shape how we should achieve faster growth and build the vision, mission and strategy for that UK business so that we had everyone pulling in the same direction, which was probably the most fun part of that role, was it was pretty easy to identify and define a strategy for growth. It's a very different game to get everyone aligned behind that, understand in simple terms what it is you're trying to achieve and get them all pulling in the same direction. So that was a great fun part of my career, trying to really get people all pulling in one route and seeing what it could achieve and what it would deliver if we were able to all pull in that same direction. And then my career kind of morphed into a sort of weird environment where I was running a skunk works of four or five people initially, where we were trying to develop new technologies for capturing consumer behavioral data and do it incredibly quickly, not in a kind of corporate environment, trying to almost position ourselves outside of the day-to-day corporate environment so we could do something quickly to compete with some disruptors in the marketplace. So that suddenly opened up a world of technology and operations that I had some sense of, but had never been kind of deep in the weeds in it previously. So I had sort of 4 years, 5 years doing that and building that business and literally from the ground up, from day one or day zero. And then that led me to the last kind of 5 or 6 years of my career at Kantar, where I fulfilled the sort of lead of operations, if you like, globally for Kantar, where my job was to ensure we were collecting the best quality data, that we were processing it in the best ways and then delivering it to clients in the most effective manner, which made for particularly entertaining time because COVID hit during that period of time and a lot of our data was collected by going to homes in India or Brazil or China or wherever and asking people to provide information to us. And of course, during COVID, people weren't wildly enthusiastic to have interviewers entering their home, or anybody else for that matter, or they weren't allowed. So we had to sort of redesign our whole business approach, or our whole operational approach, literally overnight, which was fun, entertaining, challenging, all of those things. And that kind of leads me to about 18 months ago, where I left Kantar and set up a startup business, essentially to try and compete and try to remedy some of the wrongs that I could see in the big corporate businesses that were doing market research. They were hamstrung by kind of old legacy systems, or by pre-existing data sets that had to look the same forever for clients and couldn't really change. And it kind of felt like a great opportunity to disrupt that and challenge that and move things in a slightly different direction. So I've been doing that for the last 18 months, which is equally fascinating journey and great fun, but hugely different. So that's me in a nutshell, I guess.
Maybe a good place to start is market research and what it is and how it works in your world. How would you define that?
Yeah, well, I guess there are millions of definitions you could apply, but essentially for me, it's kind of collecting primary data and harnessing and utilizing that primary data set to help clients make enhanced decisions, to improve their odds of making the right decision is probably a better way of describing it. And the world that I kind of circulated in was a very specific world around trying to capture shopping behavior. So how people shopped primarily for groceries, but how they shopped on an ongoing basis. So it's not a snapshot in time. It's about understanding someone's behavior over a period of months or years so that you can interpret change. Because the real thing that helps one shape decisions is when consumers change their behavior, being able to understand and explain that so that you can either encourage more people to do the same or discourage other people from doing that because it's counted to one's own strategy or plans as a manufacturer or retailer in the grocery world, which is primarily where my work was focused. So it was basically about trying to capture real behavior from people over a period of time to understand how they're changing their behavior, and of course, more importantly, what the drivers of that behavior might be, so that you can harness that understanding to enhance your decisions.
You mentioned obviously that you've sort of strung out on your own, made your own startup in the past 18 months to sort of correct the legacy of some of the sort of legacy systems that other people are working upon. How do companies work with, like companies such as yourself, work with research respondents today, and what are the sort of opportunities to work differently with respondents to get the better quality data and insights that you need?
It's a really important question to me, and it's something I've become very passionate about. So I think there's an industry problem in that the kind of focus of companies will generally be, how can we collect decent quality data but reward the people that are responding or providing research as little as possible? You know, that's kind of the focus, the mindset, because the more we can squeeze that, the more margin we make, the more profit we make as a company. And I think the industry is in severe risk of kind of almost running out of people that are prepared to respond properly to research, because they see and experience that the value of their data is being minimized or marginalized for the sake of profit. And actually, I think there's a huge opportunity in harnessing technology to make things more efficient, to kind of build profitability back into the businesses, and then hand a lot of that back to the people that are actually providing the research. Because if you do that well, and if you're fair or generous to people and give them their fair share of the money that's being earned from the research that's being sold, actually the quality of the data changes significantly. And that enhancement of data quality is something, as I say, I feel hugely strongly about, and what I'm trying to pursue with the company that I started up 18 months ago. How can we really get proper quality data from respondents by being fair with them, giving them the reward or incentive, or however you want to describe it, that they really deserve?
And obviously from that huge amount of data. I know for a fact, I know for there's a statistic that I saw that was like 80% of all of customer data for banks is completely unstructured, making it really sort of hard for to access any insight without a lot of work, because it's a colossal amount of data. Is there any opportunities for new technology to improve the way that market research firms collect and then analyze the data that they gather?
Yeah, it's a great question. Again, I mean, I think there's a lot of focus on how particularly things like AI can enhance data collection. So applying AI to have much more conversational type recovery or surveying of data is an obvious route that many companies are pursuing. All of that is true and definitely valid. I think, to your point, that the opportunity is greater in the structuring of data, because there's huge amounts of money and energy and manual resource that has to be thrown at the moment in trying to make sense of what is, you know, humongous big data sets now, from fusing together banking data, credit card data, primary research data sets, whatever it may be. But actually trying to make sense of those data sets is hugely difficult, and harnessing manual intervention all the time is not an efficient way to go about things. So AI and large language models and other approaches to layer metadata that enables you to make proper sense of that information and thus help make the decisions better, as I was talking about at the start of the conversation, is really where the opportunity lies. I think both to, you know, drive down cost in the industry, but more importantly, actually make proper sense of really great data, but that, as you say, is hugely unstructured at the moment. For me, that's the heart of where the opportunity.
And obviously, to point that you've mentioned AI, do you think AI is always the sort of, it's obviously something that people can sometimes see as often overrated in its use. Do you think it's always the sort of answer to use in market research now in the present day and going on to the future, or is it something that needs to always be treated as a tool?
Yeah, it's a tactical tool like many others. You're bang on. You can't see it as the panacea of all ills. So that, as I talked about before, something as simple as rewarding respondents fairly has nothing to do with AI or technology or anything else. It's just a very simple philosophical approach that can absolutely turn the industry on its head. It needs the support of great technology to drive efficiency and take cost out of the business in other ways. And AI is one of those tools that can get you to the right place. But good old-fashioned bits of tech are still really relevant. It's not all about AI.
If you could give yourself, your younger self, one piece of advice before stepping into a leadership role, what would that piece of advice be?
I think it would probably to be authentic with people, to be direct, straightforward, and it sounds cliched, but be yourself. Don't try and be some leader that you've seen on TV or in a company somewhere that you think is the leader that people follow. Be yourself, because people, you know, we're all human beings, and people respond to genuine, honest, straightforwardness. That's what people will respond to. They see through corporate blabber or bullshit or whatever the word is you want to use. You know, the people that work with you are not stupid. They can see directly through all of that kind of noise and random words. And just being honest and straightforward with people is the most effective way of getting people to follow you, I think. So had I realized that a little bit sooner in my career and not thought it was about being some sort of perfect leader, that I don't know, acted in a certain way, I think that would have stood me in better stead. It would be a piece of advice I would pass on to others without a doubt, authenticity, be yourself. Don't be scared to say things that are scary or that you think people won't like, but say it in an honest way and explain and be straightforward about it. And don't try and colour it with bullshit. Just be honest. And people will respond properly to it. Might not be what they want to hear, but they'll kind of respect you and they'll follow, maybe not the right word, but they will see it for what it is, and they'll understand it, and as such, that they will respond in a much more positive manner than if they think it's corporate jargon that's just to try and cover up something that smells bad.
I love, you've coined my new favourite phrase, they don't call out with bullshit.
Sorry. But it's true.
It's amazing. It's part of the straightforwardness. It's what people value more. It's especially what I value when it comes to advice.
Yeah, sure.
As well, there's no point in being
commercial,
like you said. And this sort of brings us on to another sort of question along following the same sort of lines. What has been your most memorable leadership role, and how did you, one, prepare for it, and two, what kind of challenges did you face in that role?
Probably the most memorable is the most recent. So the sort of running the operations piece for Kemptar, because it was a huge, huge number of people. I think there were probably about 4,500 people in that operations team, and I was the leader in theory. So, you know, that comes with some interesting challenges. A, just the responsibility for that number of people, and B, the ability to communicate authentically with them when there were so many of them. How do you do that? So that's probably been the most interesting and memorable and challenging, not only because of the scale, but fairly early into walking into that role, under private equity ownership, I was asked to reduce that number of heads by a significant amount, as is often the case in those private equity environments. So trying to do that, and that's where the kind of authenticity and honesty and transparency message really came through. That was the place I was able to apply that most, was just trying to be very straightforward and direct and honest with people about what we were doing, why we were doing it, how it might affect people, and the implications thereof. But trying to do it in a very open, transparent, direct manner was really important to me, and I think worked as a result. You know, that's never an easy challenge, but being straightforward with people definitely made life easier than it might have been otherwise.
One of the things that I find fascinating is like you say, the scale of the operation and what are some of the steps that you took to keep a personal approach or sort of a personal touch in managing such a large cohort?
Probably a couple of things resonate. So firstly, I did actually work bloody hard just to try and see a lot of people in the early days, just travel the world, literally. Get around and meet people and look at people in the eyes and say hello to them and talk to them a bit. That's hard work, but you know, just takes energy. Means you're away from home a lot for a period of time. But I remember my boss pushed me to do it. He said, you need to get out and see people. And I thought, really? That feels like a lot of time on the road. So I'm not really sure I'm doing much. But in retrospect, it was hugely beneficial for that personal connection that you describe. And then the other thing I think I kind of learned earlier in my career was the amount that people kind of mimic or follow the behaviors of leaders. So being really conscious to act in an authentic way, but in a way that you wanted everybody else to act as well, the way you expected other people to act. So being very conscious of the fact that you were modeling all the time for people, I sort of learned fairly early on and tried to be very strict with myself to act in an appropriate manner that I would want people to kind of see and then follow and acknowledge, and whether they do it consciously or subconsciously, but actually recognize, well, that's how Pete's acting. That's what's expected of the organization. And so many conversations over the years where you suddenly twig, blimey, people are actually looking at you and seeing what you're doing in the most, you know, strange environment, whether it's in the bar, whether it's on a call to someone, whether it's chatting to someone in the corridor. People are kind of not noticing and seeing and interpreting your behavior as a leader. So trying to be very good at all the time modeling what was my own authentic behavior, but what was appropriate and what I expected of other people was important to me. And then just communicate. You can't communicate enough. People need to hear the same message over and over again, to the point that you've bored yourself to tears some time prior. But you have to just keep saying what for people to hear what.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I think that's a lovely place to sort of cap our main question set. And I don't want to scare you once more, but we've got some quick fire questions.
Oh, now you really have scared.
So the first one that we have is, if animals could talk, what species do you think would be the rudest?
It's got to be hyenas, hasn't it? Anyone that's watched Jungle Book, they're horrible. They're just unpleasant creatures. they're going to be rude. They're going to be awful. Yeah, hyenas, steer well clear, Josh. That's all I can say.
In another life, what do you think your career would be?
I know what I'd like. I'd like to be a film editor. Literally, physically playing around with editing the imagery or doing CGI. And I really missed a trick. I don't think I quite twigged when I was going to university that that was even an option or something, but I'd love to have done that. I've done lots of wedding videos for mates and friends over the years and just really like it. So it's not a very exciting answer, but I'd love to do that. I think it'd be fascinating, especially now with the technology and the things you can do these days. Phenomenal.
The next one is, what was the first work thing that you were really proud of?
So the nature of my role in the early days was A, just playing around with data, but then B, going out to clients and very formally with an overhead projector and acetates and pens and all that. You're looking at me like I'm mad. You've got no idea what I'm talking about. The age gap is now becoming very apparent. But sitting there with these OHP projectors projecting charts up on the screen and basically going to clients and presenting and explaining what that data meant and what they should do. In the early days, the idea of standing in front of clients and presenting absolutely terrified me. So my first client presentation, which I think was to a private label coffee manufacturer whose name I have to admit, I can't recall now, just getting through that and surviving and not bursting into tears was my finest or my first great work achievement, without a doubt. And I do remember that my boss, who was also presenting, spilt a cup of coffee all down herself while she was presenting. I don't know if she did that to put me at ease or if it was just a total cock-up, but it definitely helped.
You've given advice to your younger self. What is the best piece of advice that you yourself have ever been given by someone else?
So I don't think this was given to me. Well, it definitely wasn't given to me because I wasn't there, but I quite like the YouTube video of Tim Minchin. You've probably seen it, where he's talking to the graduates in Australia. And I love his piece of ambition about, look, if you've got a great big dream, fabulous, crack on and chase it. But in reality, most of us don't. And in reality, if you're chasing that big dream, you're probably missing all the opportunity. You're so focused and single-mindedly chasing after one singular thing, even if you get there before you die, which is, the odds are against you anyway. But even if you do, you're missing all those things in your peripheral vision. I think he calls them the shiny objects or whatever the expression is. But I really like that idea of just set micro-ambitions. Set yourself goals. Work assiduously. Work hard towards them. But don't get too hung up on the big dream, because most of us don't really have one. And secondly, you miss so many other opportunities along the way. So he didn't give it to me directly, I'm afraid, but I quite like it nonetheless.
On a scale of 1 to 10,
yeah,
how weird are you? 10 being the weirdest.
10 being the top. I think I'm quite low, actually. I'd like to sound really kooky and quirky and different, but I'm pretty laid back, so I like people to like me, so I don't think I'm particularly spiky. And by not being particularly spiky, I don't think I'm hugely weird. So I'm going an aspiration to be an 8, but in reality a 3.
That wraps up our sort of questions for today, Pete. And I just want to say thanks one more time for sitting down to talk to me. It's been a pleasure.
It's been really good. Thanks, Josh. I've enjoyed it.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.